reconvene. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome with us students from Manitowoc Lincoln High School. Would they stand, please? A whole busload, I think. Good. We're delighted to have you. You may be seated. The students are with us with a national award-winning program sponsored by this court and the State Bar of Wisconsin entitled Court with Class. Students from around the state are invited to join us for an oral argument, and if they do, they're sent briefs in the case and may engage in a variety of activities relating to the case. And then they come to Madison to listen to the oral argument, and then they meet with a justice immediately after this argument. And we're delighted to have them with us. And they may follow this case and the opinion in the case on our website. Let me introduce the court to all of you, but before I do, let me say everyone is invited to attend the session at noon along with the students, and the discussion is on the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues of the case. So let me introduce the court to you. On my far left is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And you will meet with Justice Bradley at the end of this case. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox. To his right, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right, Justice Patience Bogensack. With those introductions made, we will turn to 04AP1519-CR, State versus Vanessa Brockdorf. Representing Ms. Brockdorf is Brian Kinsler, Attorney Kinsler. Mr. Kinsler argued the last case, too. Are you tired? Not yet.
I'm a little numb.
Okay. I'll wait until the end of this one. All right.
I'm looking forward to it. Thank you, and may it please the court. Good morning. Again, my name is Brian Kinsler, and I represent the petitioner, Vanessa Brockdorf. This case comes before the court in an unusual posture, to say the least. It is both an interlocutory appeal, and it arises from a misdemeanor prosecution. At issue is how Wisconsin courts should apply the principles of Garrity versus New Jersey in the context of criminal prosecutions. It is a matter of first impression before this court, and I note that because it is somewhat surprising, although criminal prosecutions of police officers and generally government employees are not quite as common as prosecutions of the general public, it has been well over 30 years since Garrity was decided, and it has never yet once been dealt with in the context of criminal prosecutions and in the context of suppression. I should say that the Sixth Circuit only several weeks ago, or I should say a couple of months ago, decided its own application of Garrity for the first time. So it's not uncommon. It's been a sleeping dog for some time, and I'm glad we have the opportunity to deal with it today. First, I just want to say that what Brockdorf is asking this court to adopt is a fairly common sense approach to applying the principles of Garrity. That is, that the officer had a subjective belief that their job was being threatened or some similar economic sanction. And that belief...
Doesn't this, and you talked about Garrity and that it hasn't been interpreted, but Garrity is a lot different because I'm talking factually. in Garrity, as I understand it, here you had a voluntary, whether subjective, objective, but in Garrity, weren't the facts substantially different than they were in this case, than they are in this case?
That's correct, Justice Wilcox. But I think that the principles, and Garrity is a very short decision, and I think back then decisions tended to be more short, more principle-based.
That was before computers.
Yes, I agree entirely. I wish my own briefs could be shorter as well. But the Garrity decision doesn't link the principles behind it to the specific facts. It links it to the need to make sure that police officers and other municipal employees are not relegated to second-class status from a constitutional viewpoint. The problems are obvious. When an officer is being investigated, they're not just being investigated by their employer for employee misconduct. They're being investigated by criminal investigators. There is no way that their actions can go unpunished. And in fact, because they are officers, they are subject to being prosecuted for misconduct in office, even for things which do not normally rise to the level of criminal conduct. So I think that we're dealing with a special situation that needs the special demands of Garrity applied properly. The question, though, is whether or not the objective-subjective test, that is, and I liken it to the Katz test, I think it's almost identical. In Katz, we ask, is there a subjective, an actual subjective expectation of privacy, and is that reasonable, objectively reasonable? We're asking the same thing here. It's not an overly complex test, as I think the state has suggested, and it's certainly consistent with the tests that have been applied in other jurisdictions throughout this country and for on and off the last 20 or so years, starting with, of course, Friedrich, which we cite extensively.
Mr. Kinsler, did either party submit, as part of the record in the lower court, the police department rules regarding discipline?
No, we did not. I'd like to address that if I could. I don't know if you want to follow up on your...
Well, go ahead and address that first.
I think, and looking back, we're looking back with somewhat more benefit. That is, this is an untested issue in the state, and so I think that there was a substantial lack of guidance both to the parties and to the court in terms of how this issue should have been dealt with at the circuit court level. Depending on how this court decides the issue, obviously this is an interlocutory appeal. So it's going back to the circuit court. There need not be some kind of remand. There need not be a reversal and a remand. If the court reverses it, and we hope it does, that's fine. But it's going back, straight back to the same court it came from, and the proceedings are not yet finished. So I think there may be additional factual issues that need to be dealt with, and depending on the standard that this court applies.
Well, that leads to my follow-up question. As you read Garrity and the Odson case from our court, is Garrity limited to situations where an officer is facing firing, or does Garrity extend to situations where an officer is facing discipline?
I think in following the penalty cases, we have to set a certain baseline. I think that this court, whatever the decision is, will still have much work ahead as the law develops. I think this presents a fairly narrow, well, both a narrow and a broad issue.
But how do you read Garrity?
Right. The question is whether or not there's support along a long line of cases for determining it in the basis of whether there's a penalty. I don't know that a simple disciplinary penalty, an insubstantial disciplinary penalty, is sufficient to trigger the protections. But I would say that a substantial suspension without pay would be the kind of economic impact that would definitely be considered coercive. And I think as a rule of thumb, we can continue to look to what would be coercive in any other circumstance. And a defendant who is pulled over, marijuana is found in their car, the officers take them into an interrogation room and say, I know your boss, and if you don't make a statement to me now, I'm going to get you fired. Clearly, under any set of circumstances similar to that, a court should find that that is a coerced statement, and it would be suppressed. The question for the court in police investigations and in internal affairs investigations should be similar. Would a court consider that to be a substantial coercion? If I'm threatening to put you on night shifts, I don't know. Under the circumstances, that might be a substantial penalty. On the other hand, it may not. However, I don't think there's any doubt that a pay cut or a demotion or a substantial period of suspension without pay, I don't think there's any doubt that that would constitute a coercive conduct, and therefore we would ask that Garrity be applied.
What about if that's just in the police regulations? Rather than someone saying, I know your boss and I'm going to fire you, what if it says in the police regulations that as a disciplinary, if you lie during the course of an investigation, you are subject to termination? Nobody says a thing to him during his conversation with the interrogator, but he knows or the officer knows that's in the rules.
Well, I certainly think that that's an appropriate factor for a court to consider in determining whether or not the subjective-objective test is met. I think it should be in just police procedure manuals. I think it should be determined on the basis of statutes, if statutes exist. I think it should be determined on the basis of express and implied threats as well. And I also think that it should be determined on the basis of policy and practice. There may be jurisdictions, this is not an evidentiary hearing, but there may be jurisdictions where it is a regular practice where every officer knows that if they are charged with a certain misdemeanor, they will be dismissed as a matter of practice. It doesn't have to be written down anywhere. It doesn't have to be a statute. But it's known to all parties. Under those circumstances, I find it difficult to see how certain forms of interrogation and certain modes of investigation are not going to result in very clear coercion taking place unless a defendant or an officer is given appropriate warnings about the consequences of making a statement.
Okay, Mr. Kinsler. Was there a statute here saying that if she didn't respond to questions and incriminate herself, she would be subject to suspension without pay or termination?
No, there was not.
Is there a police manual, a personnel manual, or anything else in writing in the police department that says, in the Milwaukee Police Department, she would be subject if she didn't incriminate herself to suspension without pay or termination?
Nothing we submitted to the courts below contained those.
All right. In the record, where does it show that she was expressly threatened with either suspension without pay or termination?
There is no express threat in this case.
Indeed, the trial court found that.
Yes.
Made that finding. Okay. What was said to her that would impliedly tell her she didn't talk and potentially incriminate herself, she would be subject to suspension without pay or termination?
Vanessa Brockdorf essentially put two and two together.
Where were the two and two?
The two and two consist of, one, dishonesty is a grave disqualification, and there's actually two and two and two. The first two is that officers are trained in the academy that they have to follow orders of superior officers, and if an officer asks you to answer a question, then you must answer that question. Number two...
Was the internal officer here a superior officer?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Number two, Vanessa Brockdorf was told, we will charge you with obstruction if you don't give us an answer.
That's a threat of a criminal charge, not a threat of suspension without pay or termination.
But in the context, as a matter of regular practice, it is known to officers, and that force, we would assert that it is known to officers that they cannot continue to work if they are charged with obstructing an officer. It is considered a de facto disqualification, and they are not permitted to serve on the force any longer.
In writing anywhere?
No.
Is that a practice that you showed anywhere?
No, although we discussed that, and we discussed her reasonable concerns. And I think that the court probably put both our arguments and its experience into the mix. Additionally, again, we did not have the benefit of guidance from this court on how to make out the elements, as it were, of such a Garrity claim. And so I think there was some lack of clarity there.
All right. What do you think are the elements? And let me call your attention to the statement of issue in your brief and the statement of issue in the state's brief. And let's see if that's where the two of you don't meet. Your issue is, does Garrity require suppression of a criminal defendant's incriminating statement where the defendant is a police officer who subjectively believes she must answer questions or lose her job and whose subjective belief is objectively reasonable, right?
Yes.
Okay. Their statement is Brockdorf's actual belief, which I think is comparable to your subjective belief, that she'd be fired if she exercised her constitutional right to remain silent during a police interview, sufficient to render her confession involuntary. You both agree this is a question of voluntariness, right?
Yes.
Okay. Where? So we have subjective belief in there. No one told her she would be fired if she remained silent, and there was no state law or department policy so providing. So the elements, according to the state, is a subjective belief. And if no one told her she'd be fired, if she remained silent, there's no state law department policy, the answer they would have is she loses. And you would say, as long as she has a subjective belief and it's objectively reasonable, she wins. But objectively reasonable, is that the same as being told that she'd be fired or that there'd be a state law department policy so providing? What does objectively, what are the elements of objectively reasonable?
Well,
same way of stating that issue.
To some extent, I just have to comment that I think you've hit it on the head. There seems to be a necessary subjective element. The question is what is required in order to show the objective reasonableness.
Right.
Cases generally suggest that there must be some action on the part of the state to suggest, at the very least, to a defendant that they are at risk of termination or at least at risk of substantial penalty in the employment sense,
right,
for failure to do that. The question is, should we restrict that? And I think the state's position is that we have to restrict that to an overt policy, a written policy or a state law.
Or an actual statement by the police, by whoever's questioning that she'd be fired. So there could be an explicit threat, right?
Yes.
It could be a state law, right?
Yes.
You go along with that, or the department policy, right?
Yes.
All right. But you go further.
I
so in addition to an explicit threat, she can put two and two and two together and make six.
I think the existence of a de facto policy that is not written
Okay.
It's more.
Do you have to prove a de facto policy then?
I think that should be, that is an opportunity that should be given a defendant in order to carry his or her burden.
Okay, so if the department invariably fired, if some officer was charged and convicted of obstruction, invariably fired them or suspended them without pay, and she knows that, or that would be objectively reasonable then, right?
Yes.
That's your position. Okay, what else?
Not every department is the city of Milwaukee. There are departments in, say, for instance, Burnett County, where our firm just tried a case a couple of weeks ago, where there are 8 to 10 sheriff's deputies in the entire county. The dispatcher in that county happened to be the sister of the chief deputy. I think that there are circumstances in which, as Garrity anticipates, more subtle pressures can be brought to bear. And I think that it would require...
Like what?
There are times when working in a small department, small things being said can mean a lot about what someone's future on a particular force is. And I think that the court should require that it be shown objectively, but should not limit it to those circumstances and should remain open to a totality of possible circumstances.
Okay.
Because the circumstances change so widely from one particular department to another.
Isn't that the problem? The problem is that you're asking for a rule that can be widely, it varies from department to department. It varies a great deal from whether it's Burnett or Washera County, whether it's Milwaukee or Kenosha County, as far as the, in any case, you have no written rules. There's nothing that says if you don't do this, you're saying, well, in this case, she went to the police academy. And certainly in the case of a municipal employee, other than the firefighter went to the, took this course, or the person that is the sanitary engineer went to this course. And so the court would then have to, what, look at subjective and then objective and then make a decision based on each separate case, right?
Absolutely. And I, again, because we're dealing with officers, we're dealing with Garrity, which is, to be perfectly honest, relatively obscure in case law. A Westlaw search doesn't show up 1,000 Garrity cases. I think we're forgetting that we're talking about coerced statements, and that just as an officer is concerned about, just as any defendant would be concerned.
Well, we're talking about knowing the truth. When you say coerced statement, we're just talking about what really happened.
That's right, but we undertake in other criminal cases the same totalities of the circumstances test that I would ask the court to apply here. In other words, we're talking about forfeiture of a Fifth Amendment right. Forfeiture of the Fifth Amendment right should be judged under the totality of the circumstances present, not artificially limited to some kind of department policy that may or may not be printed. Imagine how a department could avoid, completely circumscribe the requirements of Garrity simply by not writing it down. Imagine, and I happen to believe there is already something of an I say so exception to the Fourth and Fifth Amendment. Well, I said, Your Honor, I said you have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you. If you cannot afford a lawyer, you have a right to an attorney to be present. If you cannot afford one, one will be provided for you. Do you understand? I said that. And the officer in blue will be understood and more often than not, far more often than not, believed. And the defendant, with everything to lose, will not. And I think what we're looking at here is a similar set of circumstances. It would be very easy for the superior officer to lean forward and say, you know what's going to happen if you don't give me a statement. Is that an express threat?
Let me ask you something that's giving me some concern. If I read the state's brief correctly, the state took the position that even if there should be suppression of the statement at issue here, that the state should be free to use that statement if your client takes the stand and testifies, especially if she testifies obviously contrary to that statement. What response do you have to that?
I think that's perfectly appropriate. It should be no different than any other suppressed statement in Fifth Amendment context. I think that Garrity simply recognizes a subset of the same concerns that are expressed in Miranda and related cases. That there, again, if I took anyone in the room and interrogated them and say, if you don't forfeit your Fifth Amendment right to silence, you're going to lose your job.
Mr. Kinsler, as I understand it, the interview here was done, was the interview done by the police department, regular forces, or was this done by internal affairs?
It's an interesting distinction. In Milwaukee County, there are two internal affairs. There is the criminal side, that is the detectives who work for the Internal Affairs Department, who have offices on one side of the third floor of the police academy in Milwaukee. And on the other side of the floor are the sergeants, who do not wear stripes, but also wear suits like the detectives. And to an uninitiated officer, it's almost impossible to tell whether they're being investigated for an administrative internal affairs investigation or a criminal internal affairs investigation. The two blend together. In this case, the second statement was being obtained by a detective, Detective Michelle Harrison from Milwaukee Police Department, and she testified that it was a criminal investigation that was ongoing.
I guess the rest of my question is, does internal affairs get involved at all unless there is an exploration of either disciplinary or criminal proceedings? In other words, not just as part of a normal investigation of a crime on the street, but do we get internal affairs when they are investigating criminal activity of officers or disciplinary proceedings of officers? Do you understand the question?
I do understand the question, and it's hard to answer because it has been the position of the Milwaukee Police Department, at least in their testimony. We asked Detective Harrison if she offered Garrity warnings to Officer Brockdorf, and she said, what are Garrity warnings? When we litigated this in the circuit court, it was the position of the state that there was no such thing as Garrity rights. So it's difficult to say what the department is doing. I think what's most important is that this court establish a baseline around which departments can develop appropriate policies to deal with this issue, to forego the possibility that internal administrative disciplinary matters are leaked into criminal investigations that occur subsequently or at the same time, and that these matters are adequately compartmentalized, not just to preserve the rights of the defendant, but to make sure that these prosecutions go forward in a fair and just manner. Thank you.
Justice Brasser.
Police conduct sometimes is subject to an inquest, or it could be subject to John Doe. How do Garrity principles apply to a police officer in these settings?
I'm not familiar, at least not thoroughly enough, with inquest proceedings, so I can't speak to that with any authority. But I should say that if it is determined that it is a disciplinary matter, then officers should be told the nature of the questioning and for what purpose they are being questioned. And all of that should be above board so that the officer can make an informed decision about whether or not they wish to risk termination and remain silent, or if they wish to make a statement knowing that that can't subsequently be used against them. In many, many jurisdictions, not just throughout the country, but in this state, Garrity warnings are provided in exactly the same fashion as Miranda warnings are, and whichever the proceeding, whether it be an inquest, whether it be a John Doe, it should be important to notify the potential defendant and the officer what they are being questioned about, for what purpose, so that they know the consequences. That's simply not being done, at least in Milwaukee County, and I believe that's a substantial problem. Fortunately, it gives this court the opportunity to address the issue and, again, establish a baseline that will provide a departure, a departing point for departments around the state to establish appropriate policies that are consistent with defendants' rights and consistent with the rights of public employees.
Was she given Miranda warnings before she spoke?
No.
So you really want Garrity warnings, like Miranda warnings, regardless of what the rules of the department are, regardless of whether she's going to be disciplined. You want them to say, hey, listen, you're here, you speak, this could be held against you. Now, there was a whole discussion here about whether she should get a union rep in, if I remember the case.
Yes.
But is that what you want?
They should be either Garrity warnings or Miranda warnings. In this case, I don't think she understood. I think it's fairly clear from the record. She didn't have any idea that she was being questioned by criminal investigators. She thought internal affairs is internal affairs. If they had said, Ms. Brockdorf, we are doing an internal investigation, this is not a criminal investigation. Refusal to cooperate with us may result in your termination or in substantial employment penalties. However, if you do cooperate with us or you do wish to make a statement, that will be maintained for the purposes of employment and will not be used against you in a subsequent criminal proceeding. At least a person knows what they're up against and what the consequences will be.
Thank you very much. Mr. Kinsel, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Mr. O'Brien, Daniel J. O'Brien, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin. Mr. O'Brien.
Hi, good morning. Thank you. May it please the court. Vanessa Brockdorf witnessed a crime committed by her partner, Officer Jones. When questioned by police about it, Vanessa Brockdorf chose to tell lies about what Officer Jones did. Subsequent investigation, interviews with citizen witnesses, and interviews with the victim of Officer Jones's conduct revealed that there might be inconsistencies in Vanessa Brockdorf's initial statement on September 19 of 2003. When questioned again by police criminal investigators, Vanessa Brockdorf told the truth. She said, yes, my September 19th statement was a lie. Vanessa Brockdorf chose to tell the truth, as her suppression hearing testimony reveals, because she knew, and it is drummed into their heads at Police Academy, that if you lie, you could lose your job, or at very least, you could be charged with obstructing. Vanessa Brockdorf wants that second statement suppressed because she claims to be entitled to greater rights than you, I, or anyone else in this room, any other citizen who tells lies to investigating officers investigating a crime, understands that there may be severe consequences to those lies. And any citizen who admits that they lied to investigating officers of a crime understands that they may still be charged with obstructing of justice because they've admitted committing the crime of obstructing justice in their second statement. Ms. Brockdorf wants this court to take what is a very straightforward, narrow United States Supreme Court decision that protects the right to remain silent and extends it to protect the right to tell lies or to tell inconsistent statements. The United States Supreme Court, the state suggests, never intended Garrity v. New Jersey to go that far. The court intended to protect the Fifth Amendment right to remain silent. No one told Vanessa Brockdorf in either interview, the one where she lied and the one where she said she admitted she lied, no one told her, Vanessa, if you rely on your Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination, we are going to fire you. That was never said directly or implicitly. Now, Ms. Brockdorf may have believed that she might be fired, but as her suppression hearing testimony again reveals, pages 15 and 16, she admitted that she knew that if you lie, your job is in jeopardy. And, of course, any reasonable police officer would understand that. But that is, telling lies, again, is entirely a different concept than exercising your Fifth Amendment right to remain silent in the face of police questioning.
Is it the practice? Go ahead.
Mr. Ryan, you indicated that in the, thank you, Chief, that in the, in both interviews, she was not given any warnings of any sort, both the first and the second interview. And at least you drew the parallel between the normal citizen. Wouldn't the normal citizen get at least the Miranda warnings in the context of an interview with the police?
No, because there was no custody, and that's not in dispute here. She was not in custody. This would be akin to a normal citizen voluntarily coming to the police station and agreeing to answer questions about a crime that they witnessed.
There was no custody, but there was, as I understand it, an internal affairs investigation, which suggests something more than just an interview for general investigative purposes. Isn't it true that internal affairs only gets involved if they're looking at either discipline or criminal activity?
Well, in this case, internal affairs was looking at the criminal activity of Officer Jones. Vanessa Brockdorf was a witness to Officer Jones' criminal activity. Now, it is true that there is a personnel side to internal affairs investigations and a criminal side to internal affairs investigations. But that does not translate into custody for Miranda purposes, and I don't think anyone is making that argument here, and I don't think the trial judge made that finding. This is a case of, we're investigating this, we'd like you to come in and talk to us. Certainly she was free to refuse to do so if she wanted to. So she was not under arrest. She was not charged with anything. And she was told at the outset that they were investigating the conduct of Officer Jones and wanted to discuss with her statement about the conduct of Officer Jones. So I really don't think we have a Miranda issue here. And I'm really, counsel wants this court to adopt a baseline. I don't know if it's really a baseline or more of a black hole. If we have to give Garrity warnings any time a police officer is ever questioned in any proceeding, understand, it isn't just a prophylactic. We're not just saying you have the right not to give a statement. If Garrity kicks in, then anything that officer says can never be used in a criminal prosecution, no matter what the nature is of the questioning. I can see circumstances where an officer fills out a police report or answers questions at a scene of a crime that he witnessed, and a backup arrives a minute later. What did you see? What happened? And that officer, if that turns out to be false information or criminal conduct, will get that statement excluded because he said, in the back of my mind, I knew that if I didn't say anything, I would get fired. And that can't be the situation. So if you had a John Doe, you have the right to exercise. I mean, you know, if an inquest, you may have whatever constitutional protections you have. You don't have the right, if you commit a crime during that inquiry, to say that statement can't be used because I thought in the back of my head I might be fired. And again, I urge this court to read Garrity. Again, Garrity is narrow. It protects against telling a suspect that you can't exercise your Fifth Amendment right if you want to keep your job. That's all it says, because it says that is just too great a price to pay for the exercise of your constitutional right to silence.
Counsel, Garrity is in the context of a police officer, and ergo we have this case here in the same kind of posture. Is the rationale of Garrity more expansive than that? That is, if you had someone in private industry who knew and was with the same situation, self-incrimination, and if I don't tell the truth, I'm going to be fired.
My response to that is, if I witness a crime and a cop comes up to me and asks me about it and I cover it up and it's exposed later on, I have reason to think that the Attorney General might not want me to be working for her anymore. I don't need Garrity warnings for that proposition. And my lie should not be immunized. That should be used against me in any obstructing or misconduct in public office prosecution. And so as far as the private citizen goes, there's no need for Garrity warnings. That, I think most people would understand that, again, if you lie to an officer, you run a risk of whatever consequences that might be.
Well, what about the take one of these kids, one of these students here, and they're with a friend. I want to perk them up a bit. And they're with a friend, and the friend is selling some drugs, and the student then is hauled in, and indeed the student may have had some involvement at one time of possessing drugs or something. None of these students. This is very hypothetical, of course. And the student is told by law enforcement, look, if you don't tell the truth, you're going to be charged with obstruction. Is the analysis of voluntariness any different from these students than it would be for someone in private industry or police?
Well, I guess we're talking about high school students. Obviously, we're getting to the situation of the Jarrell CJ situation. We have juveniles who are more vulnerable, and of course, that gets into the voluntariness analysis, where you do look at the individual characteristics of the defendants, such as age and mental infirmity, and that sort of thing. So you do look at coercive pressures brought to bear by police.
What does coercive mean?
Well,
and it doesn't mean just I'm pressed. Listen, I'm going to tell your mother, tell your father. You know, that can be in ordinary conversation, in ordinary life, that can be coercive. But coercive has a very different meaning.
Well, I think it's something, the way I understand it, it's affirmative conduct by the police that is of such a degree that it overcomes the will of the individual to basically decide whether or not to remain silent.
Exactly. So you can have a lot of coercive stuff going on. Just the room can be coercive.
Well, sure.
Just
and
being alone can be coercive.
And I think
it has to be of a level that overcomes your will.
And there's certainly case law, this court's case law, talking about self-imposed coercive elements where you're concerned about seeing a child or you're concerned about your wife being arrested or you're concerned... You are concerned about your job, even though the police know nothing about your job. And even as far as the example of the person who is the individual, not the police officer, now, but the private citizen who says, I know your boss, and if you don't give it, if you exercise your right to remain silent, I'm going to get you fired. Maybe that particular interviewee has already taken another job at another out-of-state company and doesn't really care whether he's fired. So, I mean, that gets into the totality of the circumstances analysis, and that's separate and distinct from whether Garrity should apply to protect a police officer.
Mr. O'Brien, let me interrupt you at that point, because you said the magic term for me, and that's totality of the circumstances. My understanding was that the circuit judge here was looking at the totality of the circumstances, certainly within the framework of Garrity. One of the things that I thought was somewhat significant was that the defendant here apparently was told that she was not the focus of the investigation. And yet the result of her telling the truth was she's then charged with obstruction for her first statement. Doesn't that enter into the totality of the circumstances in terms of whether or not this was a voluntary or somewhat coercive situation?
Well, see, by my understanding, this interview initiated because the trial judge found against the detective Harrison on this, but Detective Harrison told Brockdorf that she was not the target because at the outset of that interview, were trying to figure out what Officer Jones did. And Officer Brockdorf was the prime witness to Officer Jones's misconduct. And we have conflicting statements from witnesses, from herself, from Officer Jones, and from the victim. And so at that outset, at the outset of the interview, they're trying to find out what exactly happened. Now, she then, during the course of the interview, admits that, yes, I did lie back then. Well, she had three choices. She could remain silent, exercise her Fifth Amendment right, which she was perfectly able to do, and yet she still risked an obstruction charge, as the criminal complaint alleges, for her false statement of September 19. Or she could continue in the lie. She could try to keep deceiving the officers in hopes that they believe her deception and maybe get off and get her partner off. Or she could admit the truth, admit that she lied, and know that she wasn't told she wouldn't be charged. She was told at the outset she was not the target at that point. But then when she admits that she lied, then she had to understand that she might face prosecution. It's not a guarantee.
Wasn't she being questioned a second time because the stories didn't add up? There were inconsistencies, and they thought that she had lied?
They certainly saw inconsistencies between her statement and the statement of the citizen witnesses. And so it's reasonable, as it would be with any citizen witness to a crime, to follow up. And if at the conclusion of that investigation, you find out not only that the initial crime was committed, the battery, but also that the partner deceived investigators, then you have a potential obstruction charge. And
let me ask about that, Mr. O'Brien. Assume for purposes of the question that we may agree with you that Garrity warnings aren't required in every instance. At the point when this officer, Officer Brockdorf, started to fess up and tell the truth, as you indicated, she should have known that she might be subject to prosecution. Well, wouldn't that also be true of the other officers doing the interrogation? And at that point, is she entitled to Miranda warnings?
Well, at what point? I mean, once she admitted...
At the point when she starts to admit that she told a falsehood, does that now kick in Miranda?
Well, I still don't see the custody. I mean, there's interrogation, but there's no custody.
There's no custody. Thank you.
Now, if I understand your brief, Mr. O'Brien, your position is, I think, that Garrity has no application here because there was no express threat to her that she'd lose her job or be suspended without pay. There was no implied threat to her that she'd lose her job, and there was no department policy or state statute that she would lose her job. Therefore, Garrity doesn't apply. Therefore, you apply to this issue of voluntariness the standard rules of voluntariness, which is totality of the circumstances. That's how I read your brief. Did I misread it?
I think I would stop at the lack of an explicit threat. I'm not willing to conceive of a situation where there'd be an implicit threat. I don't think Garrity goes that far. I think Garrity and...
All right.
But beyond that, you're correct that once you get around Garrity, then we're into a general totality of the circumstances analysis, looking at issues such as police coercion, susceptibility of the interviewee, the conditions of the interrogation, those sorts of situations. Yes, that's correct.
So you and the defendant really differ in terms of, as I see it, whether there has to be an express threat to get under Garrity.
I think that's right.
And you think not.
Pardon me?
And you think not.
No, I think there has to be an express
threat. Right, I'm sorry, right.
Yes. And again, it's not just an express threat that you will lose your job, but an express threat that you will lose your job because you choose to rely on your Fifth Amendment protection against self-incrimination. That's as far as Garrity and most of its progeny go. That exercise of the right, the exchange of job for silence, is too high a price to pay, said the Supreme Court of Garrity, for silence. And therefore, because of that, you can have, you as a police department can have that policy, but then that incriminating statement that is produced cannot be used if you prosecute the officer for a crime.
Now, what's the incriminating statement in this case?
Well, I think that the incriminating statement is clearly the September 19th statement where she lied, and that is the basis of criminal complaint. However, the second statement is certainly relevant evidence to show that the first statement was a lie and that, therefore, the obstruction charge could be based on it.
Right. It can be used against her because it's a lie,
but
obstruction was on September 19th.
Correct.
When she lied, apparently.
Yes.
Or was allegedly lying. Whatever happened to to Officer Jones here? Is that a public record?
My understanding is...
Can I find it on CCAP?
I believe you can. My understanding was that he was convicted of obstructing, and the battery charge, and again, I'm not going to CCAP here, but the battery charge fell out because Mr. Palacios, the victim, could not be located or something along those lines. But he was convicted of obstructing, according to my knowledge. And, you know, I just think that what, you know, counsel wants this court to believe that a police officer such as Ms. Brockdorf is being treated as a second-class citizen, unless she's given Garrity warnings. The reverse is, in fact, true. He wants greater protections for police officers than are available to any other citizen simply because they're being questioned about a crime and they don't want to give a statement. And again, the focus is much narrower. It's only on a situation where you have a state law, as New Jersey did, or a departmental policy where the officer is informed that you will get fired if you exercise your constitutional right to silence during the course of a criminal investigation. It's as simple as that. It's as extensive as that. And only to that extent do police officers have greater constitutional protection than any other citizen in this rule.
You know, go ahead.
He also inferred that this would apply to other municipal employees. In other words, that was in his statement. So what about that? We're talking just police officers here, but this could be any municipal employee.
There are cases that have extended Garrity to situations where public employees would be threatened with job loss for exercise the right to silence. And I think there's also another case, Lefkowitz, where a public contractor or a lawyer was threatened with disbarment if he exercised the right to silence and that sort of thing. But it focuses, yes, it's a broader focus than just police officers as the law has developed. But and I think there's language in Garrity talking about police officers or anyone in the body politic. But again, you still have to, A, have a express threat, and B, job loss in exchange for exercise of right to silence. And unless you have those two critical factors, then that statement remains admissible, that whatever inculpatory statement you choose to give remains admissible, regardless of your status as a city official, a police officer, a contractor with the city, those sorts of things.
The many, many years ago, the House Un-American Activities Committee would call people up, and they might plead the Fifth, which I assume because they thought they might incriminate themselves, and then they would be blacklisted by private employees, right? Suppose that was in court, or suppose that was in a police investigation. What would you do, apply the totality of circumstances, not Garrity?
Okay, so you're talking about someone who is told that they will be fired if they exercise...
No, well, listen, everybody knew they were going to get blacklisted, that nobody would hire them in Hollywood, that no one would... That was it. They were out on the street if they pled the Fifth Amendment before the House Un-Americans Committee. So I'm just going to put it now in a... context of a police investigation, and they know that once it gets out that they didn't talk in a police investigation, they're going to be blacklisted and fired. So Would you just view that under the general coercive doctrine of totality?
First of all, there's no evidence whatsoever that that's the case. I mean, police officers are
reviewed. I'm giving you my hypothetical.
Yeah. I mean, I think about in the case of the McCarthy hearings, I mean, I think the circumstances were so extreme.
Extreme things happen. In this country.
In that situation,
Wisconsin senator.
Correct.
One of ours.
Correct.
Former county judge.
Correct.
Of this state. Right?
Yes.
So what's put it?
In that situation, but again, those people, I would suggest, I guess it's hard to imagine that situation. I mean, if you can equate that to an actual threat of job loss for exercising the Fifth Amendment.
That's what I'm equating it to.
Yeah. I think the ramifications in that situation, in that era, were so much greater than just job loss. I mean, there were so many. So, I mean, I think you have a coercive atmosphere that may fit into the general.
That's what I'm asking. That would be the totality.
Yeah, that would fit into the general totality. And of course, this was long before Garrity was decided. And
let's not get into retroactivity.
But that did lead to one point that I meant to make, too. This idea that you might lose your job for obstructing, even if that's the case, Officer Harrison testified that she never told Vanessa Brockdorf that she'd be charged with obstructing, but Vanessa Brockdorf said that she did tell her that, and the trial judge so found, if I recall correctly. However, it's important, again, to recognize the distinction between telling someone they'll be charged with obstructing and telling someone they'll lose their job if they remain silent, because obstructing, you can't be convicted of obstructing merely for remaining silent. You can't, if you're questioned about, you gave an inconsistent statement, you want to revise that, if you say, at this point I'm going to rely on my right to remain silent, you can't be charged with obstructing for that. And the law is clear. And so obstructing is an affirmative false statement with intent to deceive police investigators.
That happened in September.
That's correct. So the fact that she knew that, I could face obstructing for any number of reasons is not the same as I could lose my job if I rely on my right to silence or ask for the presence of an attorney. So, I think that that's an important distinction that needs to be made here, too. And again, it's like the average citizen who knows they're caught in a lie and the interviewer says, you face an obstruction charge because you told us a statement that we don't really believe here. What do you want to do? I think at that point, the citizen knows that maybe it's best that they exercise the right to remain silent. And that certainly it's the opposite, it seems to me, than telling them you can't exercise the right to remain silent because you're going to be fired. So, in conclusion, I think the focus of Garrity is narrow. The intent of Garrity is narrow. It is a protection for police officers above and beyond protections that all other citizens enjoy, but it's a very limited protection to those situations where states and police departments threaten officers with job loss for exercise of their right to remain silent.
Counsel, I just want to touch upon that. My recollection in reading Garrity, and you made reference to it earlier, that Garrity talks about police officers and other members of the body politic, doesn't it? And I don't know what that means, but is Garrity just limited to police officers is my question.
In response to Justice Wilcox's question, I think it has been my understanding is it has been extended over time to other public officials. I think it has even been extended so far as to school teachers.
Yes, it has. And so you don't mean it's just limited to police officers when you say Garrity.
No, but in this situation we're dealing with a police officer. So,
okay.
I think that the prerequisites for Garrity to kick in are very strict and very narrow, whether we're talking about a police officer or a school teacher or other public employee. So unless there are any additional questions, I think I'll conclude my argument.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Kinstler.
Thank you. I would like to address just a couple of points, if I may, about comments of the State. It is not, absolutely not, a greater protection than are afforded other citizens. Garrity recognizes that because police officers are in that unique position, they are frequently given less rights than other citizens. That's the very reason for the existence of the decision in the first place.
Does Garrity apply to teachers, and if so, how does that rationale affect them?
That's precisely why we advocate a totality of the circumstances test. It's difficult to compare the exact circumstances that would apply to an officer as compared to a teacher. But suppose there were a battery complaint. A student complained that a teacher had smacked them in the arm, causing them pain. A principal should make a decision, just like investigating officers should make a decision. Do I want to investigate this criminally? And if so, do I want to also investigate it as a disciplinary matter? Obviously, the teacher is in a much different situation. She's going to call the police if she thinks a criminal investigation is necessary. But if she thinks that a disciplinary approach is important, interviews the teacher, and the teacher says, yeah, I smacked the student. There's nothing to prevent her, the principal, from calling police and saying that there's a student complaint, and I think it's appropriate for you to investigate it so that we can clear the air about this, and to not give that information to the police and let the police investigate it independently. I think that there's incriminating statements have become the be-all and end-all of criminal prosecutions. This is not the only society that's dealt with the issue. And I'm sure the Court is aware that there are many other civilizations that don't put as great weight in confessions as ours. But in ours, it has become the be-all and end-all. And I think that there's a concern, and it's a valid concern on the part of the State, that somehow by telling someone that they have the right not to make a statement or by giving them any kind of warning whatsoever, that they will be somehow missing an opportunity. That is certainly the case. They would also be missing an opportunity if they refrain from threatening a person. But there are opportunities that are afforded law enforcement that are legitimate, and in order to make sure we guarantee and protect the rights of people, we let them know where those lines are. We let the police know where those lines are.
Mr. Kinstler, what about Mr. O'Brien's point that by setting up this rule that you're requesting, that we would actually be giving police more rights than the average citizen, particularly given the fact that the police officers often do investigations and they have reports that they have to file, and the entire thrust of police investigations depends upon them being honest and truthful about what they're doing. Are we setting up a system that might actually impair the workings of a functioning police department?
No, I don't think so, and this is why. I think it's important to make sure that we're not either trying to fix what happened in the court below, not that I'm suggesting that, or preserve the decision of the circuit court, which we would agree with, or preserve a prosecution from going forward. I think it's important to understand that wherever the rule is, and I've said baseline before, wherever the rule is will dictate to departments and investigators, both internal and criminal, how to go about these investigations without necessarily hamstringing them, without preventing the defendant from the opportunity to make a statement, without preventing investigators from the opportunity of doing their investigations as they should. It merely prevents the unusual circumstance of coercion due to threat of job loss. It merely prevents that circumstance, unique to public employees and especially unique to police officers, from weighing in on the voluntariness of statements and whether or not those statements can be subsequently used.
Counsel, aren't we going around this backwards? It seems to me, instead of giving immunity to the police officer, we ought to say, and I don't know if you've thought about this, that a public entity cannot have an employment rule that says if an employee takes the Fifth, refuses to testify on the grounds that it would incriminate them, meaning to a crime, that that plea of the Fifth can't be used for discipline. It seems to me a much easier kind of approach. You just don't have that, allow that kind of rule. We don't have to go through all these hearings. We don't have to decide subjective. We don't decide objective.
Well,
end of it.
The interest of the state in the criminal prosecution is substantially...
The criminal prosecution, they can go right ahead on the criminal prosecution. I'm saying termination of a job discipline. That's what McGarrity talked about.
I don't think we're asking, and I don't think it is necessary to ask that private employers...
I'm talking about private, just the state, just municipal, public body. We can limit it to cops. I don't care what we do. I'm just turning it around.
Well, if you turn it around that way, I don't think there's anything illegitimate about an employer, state or otherwise, requiring an employee to provide answers in response to questions in the course of an internal investigation. And I don't know how an employer, state or private, could function under those circumstances. There is nothing illegitimate about that inquiry, nor is there anything illegitimate about a collateral criminal investigation. And the problem is when we mix the two. That's why we're asking for the court to determine when Garrity applies in the employment context. Maybe I'm not getting your question, so...
Oh, you got my question.
Okay.
I'm not sure I get your answer, but that's another question. Justice Prosser.
I'm sorry to be obtuse here, but if I were Officer Brassdorf in September, that first interview, could you just say to me what the Garrity warning is that she should have?
Being ordered to submit a report, and you must submit this report as a condition of your continued employment. You should understand that this report will only be used for internal purposes and cannot be used for any other proceeding. You may request contact with a representative of your choosing to discuss the matter, and you may reserve your rights to remain silent under the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments. However, that may result in termination from your employment. I should say that the vast majority of officers in the state actually carry one of these with them.
For the record, could you refer for the record what you're holding?
I'm sorry?
Whether you're holding a little booklet or holding.
For the record, I'm holding a pamphlet that is handed out by the Wisconsin Professional Police Association, one of the amicus parties, and which I have seen on a number of occasions outside of Milwaukee County. The WPPA does not represent officers in Milwaukee County. They are represented by the Milwaukee Police Association, which is an arm of the International Union of Police Associations, the other amicus party.
And that pamphlet is entitled?
And that pamphlet is entitled, oh, it's actually a date book. And it has in the front of it personal identification, notify in emergency. It has numbers for WPPA offices and representatives. It has an ad to save on your auto insurance. members of the board of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. Rights of the law enforcement officer.
That's under the statutes?
It does not actually, it parallels the statutes of the...
Does it have the oath of the officers in there?
It does not. And it has December of 2004. It also has Miranda warnings at the back.
I think it's and the Garrity warnings.
And the Garrity warnings at the front. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kinster. Thank you, Mr. O'Brien, for your arguments this morning on Garrity versus New Jersey. Revisited. That concludes our hearing in 04AP1519CR State versus Vanessa Brockdorf. The students should remain, and Justice Bradley will be out shortly to talk with them. We are in recess till 1:30.